We're holding the second, we're holding Chavezamid Aleph, the second line of the wide lines. We've been learning about various exceptional tzaddikim, including the last one we had with Abu Umna, with a blood letter, but we found that he has greater tzchusim even than Abaya and Rava. He gets greeted min hashamayim every day. So here's another similar story. Chavezamid Aleph, second line of the wide lines. No, from the wide lines. Chavezamid Aleph, second line of the wide lines. Rabbi Chazal, that was his name. Chazal means he was from Beit Chazoi, which we talked about yesterday. Used to very often be in the marketplace of Beit Lefet, a city there, the pastures. He was from Beit Chazoi, which is in Iran. Beit Lefet is the name of a city there. It is, in fact. I've seen references that there's an ancient city of that name in that area. Havashchiach Eliyahu used to commonly come and see Rabbi Breika. So one time Rabbi Breika asked him, Ika b'hai shuka b'ar amad osi, is there anybody in this marketplace who is a ben olam haba? Amalei, and Eliyahu tells him, Loi. No. Now what do you mean? I mean, there's a couple of different explanations Mefarshim give. One of them is Tzadik Chaim says this in Sanhedrin that you have most people in order to get into Olam Haba, they have to undergo some cleansing first. Minor, major, you know, they may have to go, like it talks about in Tanya, through Chibut HaKever or Kafakela or whatever. Chibut HaKever and Kafakela are various things that the Neshama has to undergo before it has a chance to go into Gan Eden. So what Rabbi Breika is asking Eliyahu HaNavi is, who over here is there that's going to, you know, right away have an entrance ticket into Gan Eden without having to go through any of that? And he tells him no until this person shows up who we're going to talk about. Different explanation is something along the lines of that the average person, when they go to Gan Eden, like, you know, it's a whole new type of existence. Like, they have no memory anymore of their life here on Earth. The question is, then, who is there who's going to be going into Gan Eden, where for them it's a continuation of their life on Earth, in the sense that, they'll have with them whatever they accomplished in the world. Anyway. Adahachi v'hachi, as they were talking, Chazalahu Gavra, Rabbi Roika saw a certain man to have a sayim mefani uchmi. He was wearing black shoes. Now, in those days, the Rashi says in those days, Jews didn't wear black shoes. you're not supposed to dress like a goyim. In those days, the goyim wore black shoes, so the Jews used to wear some other color. Tosfos in a couple of other places, Tosfos points out that, no, we have evidence from other places that Jews did wear black shoes as well. So rather, Tosfos says we're talking about the shoelaces. Goyim used to wear black shoes with black shoelaces. Jews would wear black shoes, but with a different color of shoelaces, again, in order to be distinctive from the guy. This guy was dressed wearing whatever kind of shoe, whatever the shoes or shoelaces, whatever it was, like the guy do.
Do we have, and I'm sorry to interrupt you, do we have actually to wear garments that are completely distinctive from the throne garments?
There is that. Well, we know the famous thing, one of the chosen that the Jewish people got out of Mitzrayim from was that they kept their own clothing. There is an interesting shuvah where Moshe Feinstein talks about that maybe not necessarily are those things it is on. And maybe not necessarily are those things so critical nowadays. Back then they didn't have the Torah yet. So yes, if they're going to keep themselves distinctive, it's only going to be with their Jewish names, their Jewish clothing, their Jewish style of speaking, etc. Nowadays that we have the 613 mitzvahs, then maybe that's not so critical. But nevertheless, yeah, there is an inyan to wear distinctively Jewish clothing. That is back to what we do.
On Shabbos we do, but
even to a certain extent on the weekdays we dress differently. It's one idea why we keep our tzitzis out. We wear a yarmulke, you know. There's a certain thing, yeah. Anyway, so this guy was wearing shoes that looked like the goyim's. And he did not have a thread of tchelas, meaning he did not have tzitzis on his garments. Nowadays, we wear a special garment in order to be able to wear a tzitzit on it. In those days, their normal garments had four corners. They were like a toga or a poncho or something. So the average person, your average Yid, would be walking around with their kapata or their coat or whatever, would have tzitzit on it. This guy didn't. He didn't look like a Jew. Amalei, but Eliyahu Navi tells Rabbi Yehuda, "Hai bar amada asihu." That guy is a ben olam haba. He found it surprising. So Hagoy Tabach adds that first he called out to him, the guy didn't come over to him. So Ruat Basre, so the Broika ran after the person. Amalei asked him, "My Ogdach, what do you do? What kind of source do you have?" Amalei, the man tells him, "Zilha Idna, go away now, tell Lamacha and come back tomorrow." The next day, Rabbi Roika meets him again and asks him, "What do you do?" Amalei, the guy tells him, "Zandrukna, no, I'm a prison guard. A prison guard. And what do? V'asana gavri l'chud v'nashi l'chud. I keep the men and the women separate in the prison. V'namina puryoi b'inhani lahani. And in fact, I put my bed in between the two sides of the room, between the men and the women, kihechad l'leisul l'day yisura, so they don't come to do yisura. Further, he says, kichazina v'asisrael d'yavri nachram aloi nayu. When I see that there's a Jewish woman over there and the goyim are casting eyes on her, like they who knows what they're going to do to her, masavna nafshoi, then I am motzid nefesh v'matzil nala, and I save her from their designs. One time there was with us in the jail, there was a Jewish girl, a Nara is a girl within 6 months after puberty, after her bat mitzvah, who was Marasa. She had kedushin already. When the goyim are looking at her, like they're trying to rape her or whatever. Shakli dudaya dechamra. So I took lees of wine, like the dregs that you have at the bottom of a barrel or a bottle or whatever of wine, which are reddish. V'shadoi lo b'shikula, and I spilled some of it on the hem of her dress. V'amri, and I said to the people, "Leave her alone. Distanahi. She's menstruating. She's having her period." They they would leave her alone. And in particular, actually, people who describe the Persian religion of that time mention that in books that talk about it, they mention that they had they had respect for that. Lahabdil, like somewhat like our dinim of Nida, they had a similar concept in their religion that they're not going to touch a woman who's in Nida. Yeah. Okay, I guess she's not going to be in jail that long. Hopefully, I don't know. No, it doesn't. What? It's under the Persians. Yeah. Amalei, so Rabbi Roika asks him, "Okay, that's quite a bit of schus, but my time aless lachoti v'romas masani uchmi. How come you're not wearing tzitzit, and how come you're wearing black shoes or black shoelaces or whatever, like the goyim do?" Amalei tells him, "I'll never nafikna beni nachrim. I'm going in and out among the goyim, and I have to dress this way. Tiyechad lo ledu diodana. This way they don't know that I'm a Jew." Because that way, kihavu gazra gzeirasa, when they're going to make a gzeira, when the goyim are going to make a gzeira, they don't know that I'm a Jew, so they don't know that I'm going to tell on them. My diner lahul rabbanon, and then I see, so this rap privy to their secrets. In other words, so I'm able to go and tell the chachamim secretly. Ubo rachami, and then they're able to daven today. The shtum mabatu l'gzerasayu, and it cancels out gzera. So therefore, I can't be dressing like a Jew.
But there's an inyan also not to dress like a Jew.
Generally speaking, you're supposed to dress like a Jew. I mean, you have cases. Another case, for example, Gemara talks about in Bava Kamma, a guy named Avtumus Ben Reuven, where the Chum gave him a heter to cut his hair in the Goyish style, again for a similar idea that he should be able to mingle with the Romans and be able to save. Yeah. You hear such stories during the Holocaust. You know, in emergency situations, you have to.
And what happens when you have a fight
between
the Arab tongue?
We're in a different
country.
In Hanami, yeah. That's true, yeah. Yeah. It's true.
There have been some women, female spies in Iran.
Yeah. Okay. Anyway. So now the question is, I mean, if this guy is a prison guard, what's he doing privy to their secrets about Xeris? I mean, those things are usually done at higher levels of government than prison guards. So there's a couple of different answers. Ben Yehoyada says the kind of gzeiros we're talking about are not necessarily gzeiros against the whole Jewish people. We mean within the jail, for example, if they're planning to institute new methods of torture or who knows what, whatever. So then, that's also a gzeiro that needs to be in this battle. There is a very interesting explanation that's given in the Sefer Deuteronomy sort of Shonim of this whole story. From history books, we find that around the time of the end of the period of the Gemara and the beginning of the Rabban and Sivarai, there was a fellow there, a Persian Galach by the name of Mazdak, whatever. And his followers were called Mazdakim, similar to our word Zandukna over here. This guy preached sort of an extreme reformed version of their religion, in particular that everybody has to share all their property in common, everybody has to share all their women in common, etc. And for a while, this guy had this Mazdak and his followers had the ear of the king over there. So you know they're very much involved in the government there. The king of Persia, yeah. For Meshach Nan was one of their followers until he realized where this is leading, and he had them all executed. Anyway, so Dora sort of showing him explains this guy over here when he says Zandukna, he does takamini the prison guard, but he has a secondary meaning in it also. Zandukna means I pretend to be a follower of this Mazdak guy. So therefore, that's now you understand why he's privy to Xerus, because he's pretending to be one of their guys.
Mazdak was at that time.
We don't really know when Reb Reuter Chazal lived. This is the only place in all of Shas where he's mentioned. No, that's Reb Yochanan ben Bereka. You're thinking of the Tana. This is an Amora. But so it's possible that he lived in the time of the Rabban and Sivaroi at the time of this Mazdak. Very. Anyway. Okay, he asked him, my time of Kiyamina Lochana, my Ogdoch. So how come Reb Reuter asked him when I asked you yesterday, what do you do? Obviously, Zilha Idna Vatalamacha, you told me go away now and come back tomorrow. Amalei says, he shaita gazu gzeirta. They had just made a new gzeira. Va'amina, and so I figured, Bereisha ezil ve'eshmalu hu l'rabbanon. I better first go. I don't have time to stand the chit-chat. Let me first go right away and tell the rabbanon, deliver achmei alo demilta, that they should daven for the thing to be nisbatel. Now that it's nisbatel, then yeah, now I have time to stand and talk with you.
Even if it would be recognized as he too?
Not necessarily. I mean, goyim and Jews did business with each other in those days. You know, we're talking about a business deal we're doing or something, you know.
I guess that's the prince guard all the whole time.
But that's just, yeah, he was on the night shift, yeah. So, of course, now Reb Reuter understood why Eliyahu and Navi's telling him that this is a Ben Olam Haba.
He and Avamina both had operating...
The men and the women, that's true. Yeah, we see that's a big thing. Adahachi v'hachi, as they were talking, Osu hanach terei achi. It says on the side that it should be achi. Two other people came by, or two brothers came by. And Amalei and Eliyahu Navi says to the Baraika, Hanach nami b'nei alma da'asininu. Those two people are also b'nei Olam Haba. You asked me yesterday who in this marketplace is the b'nei Olam Haba. I pointed out that guy to you. Now here's two more. Azalei Gabayu, so the Baraika goes over to them. Amalei humayu daichu. He asks them, what do you do? Amalei, they tell him, Inshi baduchi anon. We are people who, we're very happy people, like Batchanim. We're very happy, we're very naturally happy people, and we help make other people happy. So we make people who are sad happy. Inami and another thing we do. When we see two people who are having a fight with each other, we work on it and make shalom between them. We start telling them jokes and things to lift their spirits and all until they're able to make shalom. Which in that case, Rashi explains, you know, we say every morning in davening, one of them is, that's what these guys did. So there, yeah. There's a verse from the Baal Shem Tov that's quoted in Toldos Yaakov Yosef, and then Kesher Shem Tov, and whatever, that these guys, it's more than just they told jokes to lift people's spirits or whatever. They would work with people to help be miyached to elevate whatever these people are doing and help them become better people. But when you have a person who's an asvus, you can't accomplish anything. So first you got to get them in a good mood, and then you can start working on their berufnias.
The real chassidish. I've ever mentioned that many times.
The Mishnah had said, "Al elam asriin b'chol makom b'chol." The Mishnah had said that for the following kinds of plagues or disasters, they masriin in every place. And we talked to the Mishnah whether masriin just means they blow a shofar or say anenu or it means fast as well. So, no, why don't we learn in a braisa? "Al elam asriin b'chol makom al shidafin for blight. We talked about the other day where an east wind goes and then blasts the grain and knocks the kernels out of it. Vala Yerokan, for Yerokan, which we said there's two possibilities. Either it means jaundice of people, or it means a mildew, or it means mildewing of the plants. Yerokan means green, yeah. So either it means that people turn green, like jaundice, or it means the plants turn green from mildew. Val Arba v'chosil, and for Arba and Chosil, which are two types of locusts. Val Chai, one is Arba, comes in great quantities, and Chosil are very voracious, they eat everything. Val Chayara, and for wild animals. Rav Akiva explains, Al Shidofen Val Yerokan v'choshu, when it comes to Shidofen in Yerokan, even if there's only a small amount of it, we immediately declare an emergency. And Arba v'chosil, afilu l'nira b'Eretz Yisrael, l'konaf echad, and when it comes to Arba and chosil, even if you only see in the whole Eretz Yisrael, you see one ring, in other words, one individual Arba or one individual chosil, then already master in LA, and you right away start blowing shofar, because one is good, there's going to be a lot more coming.
Every country has a little bit of grasshoppers.
No, but we're not just talking about the kind of grasshoppers that live solitary. There's different species of grasshoppers. You have the kind that come in swarms. So the kind that come in swarms are recognizable. If you see one of them, then you know.
Trouble.
Yeah, then you know trouble's coming, yeah. I have read actually somewhere or other that actually the common type of grasshoppers that we see around, if they grow in crowded conditions, then they'll develop into the kind that eat everything. So I don't know how that is. Maybe they tend to end up growing slightly differently in that case, and therefore they're recognizable. Whatever it is, anyway, yeah. Then the Mishnah had said Baal Chaya Fula, the Braisa rather had said that for Chaya Ra, that Chaya Ra, when you have wild animals roaming around, is one of the things when Masrin, when you blow shofar or fast or whatever. So now we have to define. Tana Rabbanan, Chaya Ra Sha'amru Bizman Shehi Mishulachas Masrin Alea. This Chaya Ra that we're talking about is only if it's Mishulachas, meaning that it's been sent min hashamayim. It's not just wild animals randomly wandering around. It looks like it's been sent, because if you just have wild animals roaming around, okay, you know, you have wild animals occassionally. But if if you go out into the woods and you find bears roaming around, I mean, that's not something to start fasting and davening about. That's where they live. But as we're going to see, for example, if you have bears walking down Kingston Avenue, you know, then you know there's trouble.
There's a lot of them.
Yeah, that's mishulachas. That's the Eivish has sent them because it's not a natural thing. They normally would be afraid of people. So bismanshi mishulachas masrin aleh. So when the wild animals are sent min hashamayim, then meaning that they're not in the places or times where you normally expect to see them, then masrin aleh. Then you blow shofar for it. Ein mishulachas and masrin aleh. But if not mishulachas, then you don't. Ezri mishulachas ve'ezri shein mishulachas. So how do you tell the difference? Nidus ve'ir mishulachas. If you see them around in the city, then it's mishulachas because you don't normally have wild animals around in the city. They're afraid of people. But if you find them in the field, it's not mishulachas. By yom mishulachas, if you find the animals around by day, then it's mishulachas, and we're going to talk about soon the details, how all these fit together. Balayla in mishulachas. By night, it's not, because why? Night is usually what's the lashon apostolic over there? By night in Baruch Nafshi, yeah, the lashon over there is by tzimtzum tochay, yeah. If the animal sees two people and runs after them, then it's mishulachas, because normally it should be afraid of two people. Nach v'sbifnein, but if it hides from them, or on the side it says over here that the reef and the rosh's gear says borcha, if it ran away from them, ain't a mishulachas, then it's not. Torfa shnei b'nei adam. What happens if the wild animal killed two people, v'achol echa man, and ate one of them, mishulachas? Then it's mishulachas. Achla shnein ain't a mishulachas. But if it ate both of them, then it's not, because then we assume it was hungry. It was hungry, so.
If it eats one,
if it eats, because the Shagasalya talks about that animals don't normally kill more than they're going to eat. So if it's only hungry enough to eat one, it's not going to kill both of them.
Two.
Mashenk? So if it killed both of them, it means Sake was hungry enough to eat too. Okay, well that's kind of a normal thing according to the criteria we'll talk about in the Gemara. Okay, but whatever it is, yeah, there's different kind of animals that do that, yeah. But whatever it is, they don't kill more than they're going to eat. They don't just kill for the fun of it. Tosfos points out. If it killed both of them and didn't eat either of them, then for sure it's mishalachas. Why is it killing them if it's not even hungry? Also, a gag, v'nokul tinik me'areisa, if the wild animal climbs up onto the roof and takes a baby out of the crib, which in those days the roofs were flat. They used to spend time on the roof, so you might have the baby's crib up on the roof to catch a breeze or whatever. If a wild animal climbs up there and takes a baby out, mishalachas, then that's an animal that's mishalachas. So thus far the b'raisa. Now to analyze it. You have a contradiction. Amrit nirusa, but you're mishalachas. You say that if the wild animal is seen in the city, then it's mishalachas, which means loishnaba yom veloishnaba laila. Shouldn't matter whether it's by day or by night. Either way, wild animals don't belong in the city. V'hada amrit, and then you say by yom mishalachas, by laila mishalachas. Then you say it's only by day, not by night. So what is it? If you see a wild animal in the city by night, is it mishalachas or not? The answer is loikasha. Hachikama. What it means is like this. Nirusa ba'ir by yom mishalachas. If you see it in the city by day, then it's mishalachas. But if you see it in the city by night, ain't mishalachas, then it's not. It's not so unusual that wild animals should prowl around the city by night. If binami, or here's another possibility, in the field, even if you see the animal by day, then it's not mishalachas, because the field is a normal place you would expect to see him. In the field by night, it's certainly not mishalachas. So that's what it is. In other words, you need both. When is it mishalachas? Only if it's in the city and by day. But if it's not in the city, or if it's at night, or it's out in the countryside, then it's not mishalachas. Next one. We said that if the animal sees two people and chases after them, then it's mishalachas, which implies what? Ha'emedis ain't mishalachas, which implies, but if it stands still, If it sees them, it doesn't run away, but it doesn't chase after them either, it would not be mishalachas. V'hada amrit nachlis v'pnein ain't mishalachas. And you say only if it hides or runs away from them, is it mishalachas? So what is it? If it is mishalachas. So if it stands still, then it would be mishalachas. So what is it? The answer is like Kasha. Kan v'sada smucha la'agam. One is talking about a field which is near the meadows. Because the meadows, the meadows where uncultivated land is like swamps and meadows and whatever, that's normally where animals like that would hang out. So even if it wanders into the fields, okay, it's not an expected thing for the animals to be in the fields because the fields are the cultivated areas. But still, you know, it's not going to run away because, you know, it'll stand its ground. You know, I see these people. I'm not necessarily in the mood of chasing after them. But fine, if they chase me, the meadow is right over here. I don't have to start running away now. So therefore, the fact that it stands still already is the fact that it stands still already means that it's not mishalachas. Because it's just standing its ground because it has no reason not to. It has an immediate way to escape if it has to. The other case we'd be talking about where the field is not near a meadow. So then it has no way of escaping. If it's standing its ground, that's already mishalachas. Because what's it doing? It should instinctively know, I have no place near here to hide. It's all fields. If it doesn't run away, if it stands still, then it's mishalachas. It's lost its fear of people. Then we said, we said if it killed two people together and ate one of them, then it's mishalachas. Shneim ain't mishalachas, but if it ate both of them, it's not mishalachas. Question is, but you said that you just said that even if it runs away, it's not mishalachas. So what do you mean? It runs away, it's not mishalachas, and if it kills the two people and eats them, it's also not mishalachas. So what it ran after them, that made it mishalachas. Then it ate both of them, it lost its status of mishalachas. What happened? What's going on over here? The answer is Omar Papa Kitanyahi Ba'agma. That's talking about when you're actually in the meadow, where Rashi says it's full of thorns. It's not a place where people usually are. Yes, then you don't expect the animal to run away. It's on its home ground. So it doesn't have to. So even the fact that it's standing still, set even in the fields, is not enough for it to be mishalachas. Even if it's running after you, fine. You know, you're trespassing on its territory. So if it ends up eating the boats of the people, then yes, then that's it was hungry and you it's hungry and you came into its territory. It depends on the size of the animal. It depends how hungry it is, right? But one thing is, I think the Sfas-Emes points out that we didn't talk about what happens if it chased after one person and ate him. The answer is that's no chiddush. Of course, then in that case, it's not mishalachas. An animal is less likely to be afraid of one person. It's more likely to be afraid of two people. But we say nevertheless, if it ate both of them, then yeah, you know, it was hungry. Yeah. If they can find it, they'll kill it, sure. But we're not talking about over here. We're not talking about that angle on it. We're talking about the angle. Do we consider that the Eibishter is sending a plague of wild animals or an individual wild animal or whatever, and we got to fast and then say an annual and something? Yeah, there's no question you got to send people out to try and track it down and kill it. Fine, but we're saying, though, it's not mishlachas in the sense that it's acting normally. It's, you know, you got to go and kill it, but it's not that you haven't reached the kind of emergency that you need to be offering special tefillahs for that there shouldn't be more of this. You need to act for derech hateva at that point. You go out and find it and kill it. As opposed to, if it only ate one of them, for example, but it killed both of them, then you're saying it's something unnatural over here. That's when you're saying, besides that you've got to go and find the animal and kill it, you've got to go and daven that there shouldn't be a repeat of this with this or with any other animal. That's mishalachah. That's exactly what we're saying. That's why it's unnatural. Then the Braisa said Gufa, also Lagag Venatal Tinik Maresa Mishalachas, if it climbs up onto the roof and takes a baby out of a queer, then it's Mishalachas. The question is Pshita. What's more Mishalachas than that? Amara Papa, Kikuchi Ditsaidi. We're talking about, let's say for example, you have the roof that you're on top of is like one of these temporary huts. One of these temporary huts, like a duck blind, that people who are hunting birds set up in order to they hide inside them to catch the birds. So you have, let's say you have your family living out with you and in that place for a little while, you have a baby, you put there on top of the roof. It's not a permanent house, in other words, it's just a temporary thing. And it's out in the meadows or the forests or what have you. So only if it reaches the point. So even if the animals are prowling around this thing, fine. You know, it's their territory. It's normal. But if they actually go to the point of climbing up even onto the roof of such a thing and taking a baby, then that's already mishalach.
But one of the guys who go around thing.
Mm-hmm.
But not flat roof. The baby don't go flat.
No, not flat. But whatever. It's made out of branches or whatever, so there's room to put, you know. I don't know. Maybe it also means that the animal climbed up onto the roof and reached into the house, and then, in other words, the crib was inside. There was inside the duck blind or whatever.
That's an unusual behavior.
Yeah, the Rambam generalizes this kind of. The Rambam in Hilchos Taanis generalizes this. He says we're not talking specifically about a duck blind. By the same principle, for example, if some yokel goes and builds a house in the middle of the forest, and then and animals go and are prowling around or whatever, yeah, they smell food. Yeah, it's not mishalachas unless they go to the point of actually snatching babies out of cribs. Because again, same idea. You know, you went into their territory and started building over there instead of, yeah. The Mishnah said ala cherev chulo, that another thing that we daven for is when because of the sword, meaning when armies are passing through. It's needless to say that obviously we would have to say that you fast and you daven if there's a hostile army passing through, that there's going to be war. Even if it's a sword of peace, in other words, they're just passing through to get from one place to another and they have no designs on attacking you, you still have to daven about it. There's no case in history of a cherev shel shalom more than the case of Parei Nechai trying to pass through Eretz Yisrael, which we'll talk about what happened. And nevertheless, Yeshiyahu ended up getting tripped up by it and ended up getting killed. What happened? Shenemar. This is Yeshiyahu was one of the know about Yeshiyahu. He was one of the last kings of Yehuda. He was a tzaddik. He undid a lot of the avodah zarah and corruption and whatnot that there was in Eretz Yisrael in the years before him. He's been king now for 31 years. He became king at 8 years old, and then he gets a message one day from the king of Parei Nechai, the king of Mitzrayim. He wants to pass through the land. And then Yoshioto, he's on his way to fight against Ashur, which Mitzrayim is down here, Ashur is up here. The path to go through is lead throughout Israel. Yoshio doesn't want to let him go through. Paranachai wants to go to war against Ashur. Throughout, he's going to pass through. He has no designs on out Israel per se. He's going to fight against. So, well, actually, Ben Yoyada says an interesting thing. There was a Nevuah, which we're going to talk about in a second. There was a Nevuah from Yirmiyahu or from Yeshaya, I forget, that says that Mitzrayim is going to be fighting against. It's from Yeshaya. It's exactly Mitzrayim and Mitzrayim. That Mitzrayim is going to end up fighting against Mitzrayim because there was some Mitzrayim. There was a colony of Mitzrayim living up there in Karchemish and in Ashur, and they're on the Ashuri side. When Paro is going to go and fight against the Ashurim, including that contingent over there, so Mitzrayim is going to be fighting against Mitzrayim. The Nebuah itself implies that he has no design to fight out Israel. So Yoshio didn't want to let him go through. Wait. So Vayishlachel Malachim Leimer. So it's in Divrei Yomim. In Malachim, it just tells the story very briefly. Divrei Yomim gives it with more details. This is from Divrei Yomim. Paro sends messengers to Yoshio, Lamer, Mali Valoch, Melech Yehuda, what do you and I have against each other, Melech Yehuda? In other words, what are you interfering? Loyalacha after Hayom, I'm not against you today. Kiel Beis Milchamti, I'm just going to the place where I have a war to fight. But at least, you know. Ve'elikim Omer Lebaaleini, and Elikim said that I should hurry up. So keep away, hold yourself back from shepherding zich with the elikim that is with me, v'al yashisecha, that he shouldn't destroy you. Well, but one second. My elikim asherimi, what does this mean? What does this mean, the elikim that's with me? Amarab, zuav edazara. It means that Paro is saying, I have my getchkes, my avodazaras are going to give me success. Don't you dare tangle with them. So Yoshio says to himself, well, if he's trusting in his Avodah Zarah, then I'll be able to conquer. I'll be able to oppose him successfully. Now, actually, though, if you notice, he says Elikim twice in the passage there. He says Elikim Omer Lebaaleini, and he says Elikim Asherimi. The first Elikim, actually, many Mefarshim say that the first Elikim is actually referring to the Eibishter. Paro knew of that Nevuah of Yeshaya. He knew that there was also Yirmiyahu, who was living at this time, was saying Nevuah of how Mitzrayim is going to go and fight against Ashur. Paro and Nechoy knew about that. So he's telling Yeshio, first of all, Elikim Amal Baleini. The Elikim, meaning the Eibishter, told me that I need to hurry up. Second of all, Elikim Asherimadi, my own Getchkes are supporting me in it as well. And actually, some of the Farshim say on the Pasuk that both of them, he meant Elikim, meaning the Eibishter. He's telling Yeshio, your God is telling me to get going, so he's with me, he's on my side, so don't oppose me. Here the Gemara says that Yeshio took it to mean Avodah Zarah, but Paro himself might have meant it to mean, yeah. But what happened? In the end, they went to battle. They went to battle in Megiddo. Since Yoshio didn't want to let Paro Nechoy through, then he declared war against him. They ended up they met in battle near Megiddo, and the pasuk says, "Vayoru hayorim l'melech Yoshiyahu." The archers shot at King Yoshiyahu. "Vayomer melech la'avodav ha'aviruni," and the king says to his servants, "Please take me out of the battle." Ki ha'chaleisi ma'od, because I've become very sick. So my ki ha'chaleisi ma'od. What does that mean? Amar Rav Yehuda Amar Rav Malamet Shalosu Kol Gufi Kekvara. It means they made his body like a sieve. They shot him with so many arrows, he was punctured in so many places like a sieve. And the Medrash says that they pierced him with 300 arrows, with 300 spears. And 300 a lot of times in Gemara and Midrashim is a guzma, but still it means a very large number.
Died?
He survived a very short time after that, but yeah, he died. We'll have in a few lines what his last words were. So you see, therefore, that even though this started out as a Cherev Shal Shalom, look what became of it. So therefore, you got to be careful even around a Cherev Shal Shalom. And Mepharshim say, there's a reason for it. Even you know, first of all, things can always go sour like they did over here. Second of all, even if you have Taka, an army is passing through without any intentions to fight against you or whatever, still, anytime an army goes through, there's always harassing and looting and whatnot. You know, there's always minor incidents and whatnot. Yeah.
But
you
want to say why he didn't want to go through?
Yeah, we're going to get to that soon, yeah. Amr of Shmuel Barachmeni, Amr of Yechanan, or Yonason, Vipne Man Nenesh Yoshiyahu, why was Yoshiyahu punished and killed? Vipne Shahai Lai Limalach, Vim Yahu, Vilay Nimlach, because he should have consulted with Yom Yahu, and he didn't. my Dorash, what did he darshan to think that he should oppose Pari from going through? The Pasuk says, and then in the Brachas, and a sword will not pass through your land. And he thought to himself, my cherev, what do you mean a sword won't pass through if the people are keeping mitzvahs? Ilem a cherev she'ena shoshalim, if you mean a sword, not a peace, in other words, that there won't be war in Eretz Yisrael, you don't need that. You don't need that pasuk. But sivin asati shalom aretz. And the previous pasuk says that I'll give peace in the land. So obviously, if there's peace in the land, then no hostile armies are coming through. Ela afilu shoshalim. Evidently, the pasuk means that even a cherev shoshalim is not going to come through. So he thought his dur. He thought that the people of his time are roy to those brachas. He thought that they're all acting on the straight and narrow. Years before, in the 18th year of his reign, he had purified the Mishmikdash of all the Avodah Zarah. He made a whole covenant with the people to keep the Torah. Destroyed all the Avodah Zarah all over Israel thoroughly. So he thought that in that case they're living up to what they're living up to what they're supposed to. So sword shouldn't pass through the land. He did not know that his dur was not seen well in the eyes of Hashem. The Medrash says what happened. People in those times were very addicted to Avodah Zarah. We know the famous thing, the Gemara we had in Yuma, about that they had the Yetzirah for Avodah Zarah in those times until the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah 100 years later got rid of it. 200 years later, actually. Not 100 years later, yeah. So what happened? You had people who were so addicted to Avodah Zarah. You know, Yoshio's policemen are going all over and clearing all the land of Avodah Zarah. What people did is they painted images of Avodah Zarah. They made themselves folding doors in their houses, the kind of folding doors where they fold in half. They painted Avodah Zarah pictures, images of Avodah Zarah on the back of the door. When the door is closed, then you have a complete image, and they had what to worship. When it's open, you don't notice. It just looks like a geometrical design or whatever. So the policemen, when they're searching through the houses and checking for things, they didn't notice these things. The doors are open at the time. And so therefore, so Yoshio didn't realize that's what's going on behind the scenes. He should have checked with Yirmiyahu. He should have checked with Yirmiyahu. This, first of all, is my understanding of the pasuk correct. Second of all, are we Taka in a position now to be zeicha for this? And he should have known Taka. This is during the period. Yirmiyahu is going out every day and screaming how there's going to be a churban and there's going to be a galus if you don't do tshuva. So Yoshio should have realized something is not quite right over here. When Yoshio was about to pass away from all his wounds, Yirmiyahu saw that his lips were moving. He was saying something. He thinks to himself, is he chas v'shalom saying something improper from his tzar? Maybe he's saying something. It's true, you don't blame a person for what he says v'shas tzar, but still, you know, gochin, he. So then the point is, Mephoshim say, he set a whole hesped for him, which became the fourth parak of Echa Yuam Zahav. That whole parak is talking about how the gold and the splendor and everything of Yeshiyahu with the tzaddik was dimmed. So if Chas v'Shalom Yeshiyahu had been saying something improper, he still would have set a hesped for him, but not quite to that extent. He wouldn't, you know. You can't correct a dying person. Right? Anyway, Gochin, he leaned over, and he heard that he's being mastic, that he's accepting the Eibishter's justice on himself, and I'm talking right. That the Eibishter is talking right. Omar, he's saying, Tzadik hu Hashem ki piu marisi. The Eibishter is tzadik. I disobeyed his voice. I should have listened, that there's that Nevuah, there's that old Nevuah from 100 years ago from Yeshaya, that Mitzrayim is going to fight against Mitzrayim, so I shouldn't have stood in the way, and I should have checked with Yirmiyahu to see whether the Vecherem Leisav of Arzachem applies now. So at that point, Yirmiyahu started saying a hesped on him with the pasuk Ruach Hapeinu Mashiach Hashem, the breath of our nostrils, the anointed one of Hashem, as the pasuk continues, Nokad B'Shechisayim was caught up in their snares. That's from Perek Talad of Eicha. That whole Perek is a kina about Yoshiyahu's death. That now the Churban is going to happen, and then there's going to be all that disaster. Well, that's from there. Things started going downhill. You had four sons or grandsons of Yoshiyahu were king over the next 22 years. All of them were Rishayim, except okay, Tzidkiyahu was a tzaddik, but the people were Rishayim, whatever. But it was going midechi al dechi. Only three or four years after that, Nebuchadnezzar conquered Eretz Yisrael and made the king of that time Yehoyakim his vassal. The Paranachai in the end wound up going after he killed Yeshayahu. His army Taka went up to Karchemish over there, and they ended up getting defeated. The Haftarah that we say, Parshas Boy, the Haftarah of Parshas Boy is a Nebuah from Yirmiyahu talking about how Paray's power has been broken by that defeat.
Maybe not.
So.
But his Nebuah was to go fight.
Yeah. So.
To go fight
Asher, right? Maybe. Right, so maybe the fact that he detoured, and ended up fighting with Yeshayahu, maybe that can. Anyway, maybe it may have been more than that. It may have been that the Eibush L'Hatchila wanted. You know, the Eibush never said in these Nevuahs that Mitzrayim is going to win the battle. Just there's the Nevuah. They're going to go fight. You know, it may have to be. This is the Eibush wanted to break their power, and this is how he's going to do it. So one thing is, there's an expression that we have in a few places, Chol Kikvara, I think the Rashash says it. You have, Rashi brings it on, for example, Kibras Eretz, when Yaakov says, when it says there was only a Kibras Eretz to come to Beis Lechem, and then Rachel passed away and they buried over there in Kever Rachel, Rashi quotes over there from a Medrash that the land at that time was Cholula Kikvara, it was hollow, and it was hollow like a sieve, because it was a dry season. So we see, therefore, that there's an association between a sieve, between being shot full of arrows like a sieve, and hachalasi, melosh and cholu.
That's
now a lot of people, yeah. We have, by the way, one of the kinnis we say on Tisha B'Av is in fact the Python, probably Rav Elazar Kahler, took each of the psukim from Perek Dalet of Eicha and explains in the piyut how it refers to Yeshayahu, what he was, what he accomplished, and then how he died from this. In the psukim over there, actually in Divrei Hayamim, after Yeshayahu was killed, and it says that Yirmiyahu gave a hesped on him. It says that everybody was crying and mourning for him and became a l'choik b'Yisrael. That's part of that is Rashi on Divrei Hayamim says over there that it means that every year in Kinnis we say a kina about Yeshayahu. Mishnah said, "Ma'ase v'yod u'skenim Yerushalayim la'orim." Chula that it happened once that the skenim went down from Yerushalayim to their various cities around Eretz Yisrael, and we said they declared a tainus because there had been a shidofin. There had been a blight that affected kimloit pitanu. The amount that would fill an oven, that would fill the opening of an oven, even though it's a small amount. In other words, they were afraid it's going to spread. So we boil it. Kimloit tanu tvor, or duma kimloit tanu pas. Does that mean that you're talking about enough tevuah to fill up a whole oven? Like if you were to just take the raw grain and then pour it into the oven, enough to fill up the entire oven from top to bottom? Or maybe does it mean the amount of wheat that you'd be able to use to make bread that would fill up an entire oven full of bread? Which would be a smaller amount then, because if you're stuffing the whole oven full of wheat, then fine, you know, every little bit of it is full of wheat. If you're baking bread in an oven, you don't put bread throughout the whole oven. You stick it to the sides, like we learn in various places. So therefore, that would be a lot less. Yeah, because you need the middle space for the fire. Yeah. Tashma kimloy pi taner. A braita says that it was kimloy pi taner, like what would fill up the mouth, the opening of the taner. So okay, we know it doesn't mean the whole taner. Okay, but still you have a question. Kikisuya de tanura, does it mean enough wheat to be able to make one loaf of bread that would cover the whole top of the oven? Or maybe it means like a row of bread, which goes around the opening of the oven. In other words, here's your oven from those times. It was open on top. It was open on top. On the bottom, you have the coals and whatnot. They'd stick the dough along the side. So does it mean enough to make one big loaf that you put over the top over there to bake? Or does it mean enough to make a bunch of small loaves that you put 1, 2, 3, 4, however far down, and then all around like that, a whole oven full of bread, as many loaves as you would usually be able to put in? Yeah, but that's why it's narrower towards the top, so more of the heat stays inside.
Would it still remain sticking to the walls?
Yeah, but that's why we've learned in Shabbos, we've learned in Beisa, and a couple of places that taking bread out of the oven in those times was very difficult. It's chokhma v'einim malacha, because to take it out without dropping it onto the bottom of the oven was chokhma.
Why did they have to do it vertically instead of horizontally?
I don't know. That's how they made their ovens in those days. So, as far as that last detail, Tekel. Then the Mishnah said, that they also declared a tainus because wolves had eaten two children in Evra Yarden. So, speaking of this, the Gemara brings another din. Or maybe it was even the same story. Because it happened once that wolves swallowed up two children, and then they excreted them out the other end. The matter came to the Chachamim. There was a matter of the fact that they had to make. Besides that, you have to ask about the issues of Tumah V'Tara that are involved over here. So they declared the flesh of these children tar, because it already passed through the animal's digestive system. It's not flesh anymore. But they declared the bones are still tummy because those didn't get digested. No, but if you go, I mean, the pastors, they would have wanted to recover the pieces in order to bury them. But you have to know, the Chachamim were informing them, you have to know, there's a din involved over here. The flesh of the children is not tummy anymore, but the bones still are. And people were careful. It's Tumavatara in those days, so it's halacha, you need to know.
So the bones are always tummy.
Actually, some of the Farshim talk about if the case over here was, we said, Bolu Zavim Shnetinok, because if they swallowed them, in other words, whole, if they had actually chewed them up, they would have chewed up the bones as well, and the bones also wouldn't be tummy.
Right. But I mean, if the bones remain...
Then that's the point. That's the Chiddush. Even though they went through the whole digestive system, they're still, yeah. Then the Mishnah said, Al Eidah Masriyan B'Shabbos, Cholod, for the following things, you can cry out even on Shabbos. And we said, cry out over here, Masriyan here doesn't mean blowing shofar, because you don't do that on Shabbos. It means crying out, saying, Anenu Hashem, Anenu Elokeinu, Anenu. And we had the Mechloikus in the Mishnah, where Rabbi Yossi says that you can only do La Ezra, V'Loi L'Tzaka, you can cry out to get people to help, but not to dab into the Eivishter, because not covered Shabbos, or according to Rashi's second explanation, that you can do it in private, but not in public.
Shabbos.
Yeah, on Shabbos. A city that was surrounded by, that was besieged by Goyim, or surrounded by a river, which is gonna flood it. Or whether you have a ship that's tossed around in the sea and it's gonna sink. Or an individual. Up until now, we're talking about groups of people or a whole city or whatever. Now you have an individual. Shenudaf mifnei nachrim was being pursued by goyim, mifnei listin, or by armed robbers, or mifnei ruach ra, or he's being pursued by an evil spirit. What does that mean? Rashi says that in other words, there's a shed or something like that got into him. So now he's running around crazy. And now he could fall into something. He could fall into a river, or he could trip, and you know, whatever. He's in great danger. For all those things, maybe you don't make a tainus for the tzibur for all those things, but an individual is entitled to afflict himself with a tainus. Rabbi Yossi says, no, an individual should not afflict himself with a tainus. Shemi, it's darach labrius, because he may end up needing tzedakah from people. Why, Rashi says, because he's going to be, after fasting, he's going to be too weak to work. So then he's going to need to collect tzedakah. They ain't a brias merachmas, Sullivan. People won't have rachmanas on him because they'll say, you know, you brought it on yourself. My time is Rabbi Yossi. What's Rabbi Yossi's reasoning? Where does he get this idea from? Just the pasuk says, "Vayhi Adam lanefesh chaya." The Eibushter made Adam. He made him into a nefesh chaya, into a living spirit. Means the word chaya means neshama. Shenasati b'chad neshama that I put into you. Hachayeha. Make sure you keep it alive. So don't afflict yourself unnecessarily. Mephoshim talk about over here that one thing is, in the cases we were talking about before, in the cases of rain or the different other disasters that we're talking about, Arba and then all these things where we said that you declare fast, that the fasts are usually Monday, Thursday, Monday, we said. When it comes to these things that involve a yachid, or for example, you know, some of these things, there's no delay possible. I mean, in the case of a guy with a ruach ra, for example, you know, you can't wait until next Monday to start davening for him. So it means l'sagafasatmatainis might even mean to be fasting for like a couple of days in a row. That's why we're calling it l'sagaf, like the torture himself. So we have the Tanakhama saying you can, and Rabbi Yossi saying you shouldn't. Which this is why, though, you know, we had back in the first parak, we had a machlokas between Shmuel and Rabbi Lazar, whether somebody who is fasting is called a kodesh or whether he's called a chayte. And we talked about over there the possibilities, part of it depends whether he can stand it or not. So one thing is over here that So Tosfos points out over here that actually here we're talking about obviously that in a case where a person is not able or would not be able to, see, would be a chayter, nevertheless is he allowed to? Then you have Rav Yossi saying he's not even allowed to. But other Mepharshim say it's not the same thing. There we're talking about fasting unnecessarily, not unnecessarily, whatever. There we're fasting, but fasting voluntarily on Mondays and Thursdays. Here we're talking about fasting voluntarily like for a couple of days in a row or whatever. For a chayla or whatever. So that's a different thing. Even the opinion over there, even Rabbi Elazar, who said there that Nikra Kodesh might agree over here with Rabbi Yossi that says that you can't be misagif yourself. Then the Mishnah said, Shimon HaTimni Omer Achol HaDever Chula, that Shimon HaTimni said you also cry out for Dever, for an epidemic. And we said the Chamim did not agree with him. So Ibayilahu, they had a question. What does that mean? Doesn't mean the Chachamim did not agree with him when it comes to Shabbos, that you can cry out or whatever to daven about an epidemic, but they agree that on weekdays you can. Maybe it means they disagreed with him that even on weekdays you shouldn't be. Tashma, Titania, Masrin al Deva Shabbos, you cry out about a plague, about an epidemic on Shabbos, the Ain Sarachlam of a Choyal, needless to say on weekdays. But Rab Chonin ben Pitum, Talmudish, Rabbi Kiva, Mishum, Rabbi Kiva, no, Ain Masrin al Deva Kol Iker. You do not cry out about Deva at all. So therefore, in other words, you have a three-way machlokes over here. We have the first chachamim in the Mishnah who said that you do cry out and even fast for Dever, and we said different things. You have a city of 500 people with those three mason one after the other each day. On Shabbos, then you had Shimon HaTimni saying even on Shabbos, and you have Rav Chanan ben Pitrum, who's the loy hodu loy of our Mishnah, that they say you don't do anything even on weekdays. Now why not? Rashi says over here. Rashi says, "Afilu b'chol, you're not even masriyan for dever on the weekdays. Digzera he, because digzera. Now, what does that mean? So, some Mepharshim say it means it's because an epidemic is such a serious thing. If people are allowed to be masriyan on weekdays, they may end up doing that on Shabbos as well, and you don't want them to do that. So, therefore, the Rav Chanan ben Pitrum says, in the name of Rabbi Akiva, we don't want you to even be masriyan on weekdays either.
Why didn't you say that they? If it falls before Tuesday or Wednesday, they can. Because
we don't know how long an epidemic is going to last. It's not like it's going to be overnight necessarily. I did see an explanation from Rav Avadia Yosef that he wants to say that the reason why you shouldn't is basically because when you have an epidemic going on psychologically, especially if you're fasting, but even if not, if you're crying out and whatever, that itself has an effect that it makes you more susceptible to it. You're lowering your resistance. Adaraba, don't be masriyan even on weekdays so that you keep yourself healthy and strong so that you'll survive it.
Anything else?
No, because most other things it doesn't necessarily depend on your health. So, you know. So to pray, but Masriyan is more than just praying. Masriyan is blowing shofar, crying out on Anu or whatever. That's
not. But
no, but it's not covered Shabbos either. No, it wasn't the Anu. No, that's the last seven fast. We don't know. That's not necessarily what. We said at the beginning in the Mishnah there were some Mepharshim who explained Masriyan that way. There were other Mepharshim, other Rishonim who explained that no, Masriyan just means saying Anenu or just blowing a strip or whatever. But even so, saying Anenu Elokeinu Anenu Avinu Anenu, etc. That whole thing on Shabbos is not covered for Shabbos.
You know it's going to help.
But do you know that it's going to help?
That's the whole thing.
Yeah, I mean that's what Rashi had said on the Mishnah. Not necessarily do we have to guarantee that our tefillahs are that of the caliber to be answered. So on weekdays.
So rather, yes.
Okay, but even so, so we're saying so. So yeah.
It's not considered
chil
Shabbos.
Yeah, chil Shabbos, but it's not recovered for Shabbos either. The Mishnah said, "Our kol tzara shalei tovel tzibruchul." The Mishnah had said that for any tzara that might happen to the tzibru, you always must be on it, except for too much rain. Except for too much rain. My time, because you never daven that there's too much good.
Look,
that you want it taken away. And again, we talked about the other day. We're not talking about with ruining the crops or whatever. We'll get to that. We'll get to that soon. We're talking about that it's just it's inconveniencing people. How do we know that you don't daven for too much good? Shenema, the pasuk says, bring all the ma'aser into the treasury, and if you do, we learned this in the first perek, that you can test me, that I will give you brachas ad v'lidai. My ad v'lidai, Amar Rami bar Rav Yud, ad sheyivlus, if sesechem ilayim adai, until your lips are wearing out from saying dai. So what does that mean? It means, in other words, that here the Eibishter is giving you so much good, and he's promising, I'm going to keep on giving you good, and you know, you're not davening. So even Adar Abba Mephoshim say, why? You see, you're saying, die, and you will lose the seichem. The answer is yes, but you see the Eibishter is not answering you. Why? Because you're not supposed to daven, because you're not supposed to be saying die.
Because as much as he
gives you, yeah. Amar Rami bar Rav Yud, uva goylam asurin aleha. However, in the goylam, meaning in Babel, we do cry out when there's too much rain. Because bubble is a different kind of climate than Eretz Yisrael. Too much rain is bad for them. Eretz Yisrael is a different climate. It's a bracha.
So higher,
I don't know.
What is it? So higher?
It's higher. It's like mountainous. It doesn't get as much rain, yeah. Tani nami hachi, shanag shamea merubin, when you have a year when there's a lot of rain, anshe mishmar shocham anshe maimin, then the people of mishmar of that week's group of koyanim who are serving the mishmar would send a message around to the anshe maimin, the Jews who are representing the rest of the Jewish people for that week. They would say, tnuei nechem ba'acheichem shabagoyla, give your attention to your brothers in the goyla, in Babel, shalo yehe bateim kivreihem, that their houses should not become their grave. If it rains too much over there, their houses are going to collapse on them. So that's the difference between Eretz Yisrael and Babel. Babel is a swampy, low-lying, wet area. So yeah, too much rain can damage the houses. But Iraq, I mean, nowadays Iraq is fairly dry, but in those days it was a lot
between
more.
Between the two rivers,
yeah. I have seen though, actually, in the times of the early Achronim, they did say that when they were living in Tzfat in that area, that yeah, they were also, the houses sometimes were built very flimsy as compared to like Yerushalayim. And yes, they were also, you could have that too much rain would be bad. So sometimes they would also daven when there's too much rain for it to stop for the same reason, because it's not just Eretz Yisrael versus Babel, it's however the houses are built and how, yeah. Yeah. Whereas later, in later times when they started building houses more substantially than that, then they don't have that. Shalos Rabbi Yezer, ad heichen kshamim yodin v'yispaldu shalo yodu. How far can rain, as the rain has to fall, that you can daven, that it shouldn't fall anymore? Amalami tested them, kadeshi yamad adam b'keren ofel. If there's enough rain that a person can stand on keren ofel, Rashi says that keren ofel is a very high rock peak. Well, keren ofel. Shen sela gavoya, like a very, very high peak of rock. And get his feet wet in the water. In other words, you'd have to have then for the water to reach up to the top of a high peak like that. You know, you'd have to have like hundreds of feet of water. In other words, he's saying, you know, realistically, it's never going to happen. That was Chonim Agul. He said, "Ad shenim chaseven atoyin." Yeah. Similar idea, but yeah. There is an interesting explanation, actually, that Keren Ophel over here actually means that there's an area of Yerushalayim called the Ophel. And nowadays it's like the southern end of the Harabayas. Used to be outside the Harabayas, used to be part of the city. The wall, the eastern wall of the Harabayas over there, right outside Yerushalayim over there, is Nachal Kidron, which in those days was very deep. Nowadays it's not quite as deep, but the Nachal Kidron is deep. The wall in those times was a lot higher than it is now. That's the Keren Ophel that we're talking about over here. If you're standing on top of that wall and you have water filling up all the way from Nachal Kidron all up, well, there, you know, it'd have to be hundreds of feet. So it's not going to happen, basically, you think. Yeah, what do you mean? Valtanya Yodov. A different Braita says that Rabbi Eliezer told them that if there's enough water that you can soak your hands in the water when you're standing on Keren Ophel. The answer is raglo kiyodav kamina. It means that he can do both his hands and his feet. If he can dip his feet in the water, then yeah, he can bend over and dip his hands into the water too. So it amounts to the same thing.
And meaning what? It's not that high?
No, meaning it's pakeret. It means it's very high.
Very high.
Yeah. Amar Rabba Baba Chana, let me tell you.
There's a big difference if you could...
No, because you can bend the point in. Once you're standing on there and your feet are in the water, then fine. You can bend down. You can crouch down and get your hands on the water. Yeah.
It was right there.
Yeah. Omer Rabba Baba Chana, Lididi Chazili Keren Ofel, I once saw this Keren Ofel, to come Hahu Taya Kirochiv Gmala. There was an Arab riding by over there on a on his camel. Venuket Roim Chabiyada, and he was holding a spear in his hand. So I'm standing on top of Keren Ofel. He's riding along on the valley below. Mischazi Iniva, and he looked like a worm because I was so high up. Or Rashi has a second explanation. An Inva means a nit, like a louse egg, even smaller than a worm. So the point is that he was so high up, that Keren Ofel was so high up compared to Nachal Kidron, or compared to wherever next to Keren Ofel is, that he had to look tight. Yeah. Bottom, we learn in a Braisa, but when the Pasuk says, V'nasati gishmeichem be'itam, that I'll give you rains in their time, means lo shchura v'lo tzmeya, the land won't be like drunk, there won't be too much rain, because that makes the ground all swampy and muddy. V'lo tzmeya, not thirsty, elabendinus, but average. Shekolz man shagshom emirovin, because when you have too much rain, metashtishin is ha'aretz, they make the land swampy, v'ainim etzi aperitz, and it doesn't give out fruit. Dava Acher, another explanation, v'itam, when it says I'll give rain in its time, means v'leil revi'i, so v'leil shabbos, this means on Tuesday night and on Friday night. Leil shabbos means Friday night, so leil revi'i means Tuesday night. Why? Because we learned in Pesachim that those are the nights when Shadim are around. Well, in particular, Tuesday night is one of the nights when Shadim are around. So therefore, people don't go outside, and Friday night, people aren't going around because Shabbos, they're not traveling. No, it's means Tuesday night. So we learned in Pesachim that originally they used to be around all day until I think it was Rav Chanina ben Dosa got them to only limit themselves to twice a week, and those were the nights that he set up.
Why
now? Halfway through the week, I don't know. Tuesday night and Friday night. Shekain matzinu b'mei Shimon ben Shatach, thus we find in the times of Shimon ben Shatach, Shiyot b'hem b'shamah b'lei l'viyas of l'leil shabbosis, there fell for them rain only on Tuesday night and Friday night, ad shenasu chitim k'kloyis, but even so, there was enough rain, there was so much rain, that the wheat kernels grew as big as kidneys, u'sa'orim k'garin ezeisim, the barley grew to be the size of olive pits, v'adoshim k'din rezahav, and the lentils grew to be the size of gold dinner coins. And what they did, they actually racked up examples of those to be able to show future generations. In order to show, in your times you have normal sized ones, but look how much chet causes. Look how good you could be if you do what you're supposed to, like they did in the times of Shimon ben Shatach. Shenema, as the pasuk says, "Avene seichem hitu eila, your averus have turned these away." V'chate seichem manu atoyv mikem, and your chatoyim, your averus have taken away the good from you, because you see what the potential of Israel has. So we also find in the times of Hurdus, they were involved in rebuilding the Bismikdash, because Hurdus rebuilt it much more beautiful than before. So it would rain only at night. The next day, every day, the wind would blow, and the clouds would clear up, and the sun would shine, and the people would go back to the work of building the Mismikdash. And they knew that what they're doing is malacha of Hashem, that Hashem approves of it. Even though Hurdus is doing it for his own covet, and has a kapara for having killed the Tamar Chachamim, and whatever, but still, they just showed his approval of it that way. Because the fact that the rain only happened at night in order not to interfere with the work. It's interesting, actually Josephus in his history mentions this detail also about when Hurdus was rebuilding the Bais Mikdash, that the Eved Shem showed them favor by making it rain only at night.